one of the most recognizable voices in sportscasting. It should be, considering he did it for more than four decades. His name is Pat Summerall, truly a legend in the broadcasting game, doing football, golf, tennis, and who knows how many other things he did. He has now written about his career and his recovery from alcoholism in a new book called Summerall, On and Off the Air. Pat, welcome to the Paul Harris Show.
Thank you, Paul, very much. It's a joy to be with you.
It is a pleasure to have you on here today.
Thank you.
It's, what, been 4 years since the intervention?
No. It's been since 1992.
Oh, 14 years.
14 years, yeah.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Haven't had a drink in 14 years.
When Tom Brookshire and your friends came to you and said, look, we're going to deal with this, and we're going to deal with this now, was that hard for you to take?
Well, it was a shock. They surprised me with the whole meeting. It was not just Tom. It was a group of people that I knew and respected and feared in some cases. And they surprised me. They lied to me to get me there. So it was, my reaction was first anger that they were telling me how to manage my life. But after I listened to their stories and things that they had seen me do and things that I would be ashamed of and things that they were ashamed of and how much they cared for me, I listened and I went to the Betty Ford Center.
Had you remembered every story that they mentioned there, or had some of them kind of been part of your blackout time?
I don't know that I ever had a blackout time. I didn't remember everything that they recounted to me. I remembered being in particular places and doing some things, but I didn't remember all the details that they did and they presented to me. Each one of them had been there for a couple of days. That's the way I guess these things work. And they had written in longhand on legal pads all of the things or some of the things that they had seen me do that I would be ashamed of and that they were ashamed of and sorry for, and so was I when I heard them read back to me.
I was one of the many American football fans who grew up hearing you and Tom Brookshire call the games for all those years.
Right.
Why did you two break up as a team?
Well, I think CBS had the foresight, number one, to put me with John Madden. Number two, to save both of our lives. I think if Tom and I had stayed together, there's not much doubt in my mind that we would have killed each other, either in an accident or with lifestyle or whatever. It was a good thing for both of us that they broke us up.
You were not just on-air partners, but off-air partying.
We were having a good time.
What was the first time you worked with Madden?
As a matter of fact, Tom had a conflict. We had done a Thanksgiving Day game, as we did so many of those, and CBS wanted us to broadcast the game the following Sunday after Thanksgiving, and Tom wanted some time off. He had a commitment somewhere. And so he didn't do the game. So I had nobody to work with. It was in Tampa, Florida, Buccaneer-Giant game, which might have been the worst game I've ever seen. But instead of Tom Brookshire, I worked with John Madden. And we clicked off so well and hit it so well that they decided to make us a team and break Tom and me up.
Did you do run-throughs with Madden beforehand, or was that the first time you two had ever done anything together?
It's the first time we had ever done anything together. I had met John, of course, when he was coaching the Raiders. And I knew of his reputation. I knew what kind of guy he was. I did not have any idea he was going to be so good or have had such a unique style. But after about a quarter of sitting there working with him or standing there working with him, I knew that he was something special. I didn't know how well we were going to fit together, but I knew he was going to be good.
Now, you've been doing this for quite a while, and he's the rookie. Was he nervous?
When I first saw John that day at Tampa Stadium, they had built sort of a temporary platform for us in the upper deck, and it was a high stadium anyway. And John was with suit and tie, which he hates, but he had it on. And he was sweating like I've never seen. He's so profusely, I thought, this guy is so nervous and so scared that this is not the business for him, and that he better get into something else. And then I didn't realize at the time that the reason he was sweating was because he was afraid of the height. It was not because he was nervous about being on the air.
Oh, really?
It was just he was so scared of being up so high, and he wasn't really supported as well as a temporary platform they had built for us to do the opening shot so he could see the skyline of Tampa in the background. And that was what was upsetting him, not so much the fear of being on television.
You know, that may explain a piece of audio I have of you guys. And I've played this on the air a couple of times as kind of an example of how silly things got on the air with the two of you, particularly during either blowout games or games where you guys, you know, were trying to fight the boredom that you probably felt that the viewers were sitting through. And if you listen to this, at the beginning of it, it almost sounds like you're taking a shot at his fear of heights. Listen to this, Pat.
Okay.
Now, this might be the highest above the field that we've ever been. You know that, in the Husky Stadium?
And then kind of out, too. Yeah. And then that's probably because it's a cantilever. This is a cantilever field. And, you know, cantilever, I think, means this stuff where we got this overhang. See, I think when you go up and then you come out like that, that means cantilever. Mm-hmm. Or that's what cantilever means. So we got a cantilever stadium here. And then we're up above in the cantilever. The cantilever's over our head. We're up above looking down. Now you're talking.
Now, I got to tell you, when I first heard that, I thought to myself, you know, they're talking about this cantilever thing, or at least Madden's going on about this, and the game is going on in the background. You can actually hear the whistles and all that sort of stuff. Are you sitting there next to him thinking, can I get back to calling the action?
At that time, we were at the old University of Washington Stadium in Seattle, and I remember that definitely. John almost didn't do that game because we were in that cantilevered section. He almost said we got to go down and broadcast from the concession booth that day. He finally got up to the booth, and there was some apprehension, I can tell you that.
What was the change in broadcasting style that you had to assume going from working with a longtime partner of Tom Brookshire to a guy like John Madden?
Not really that much. John and I had something that I think is very, very difficult to come by, in that he seemed to have a sixth sense of knowing when I was through talking, and I sort of knew when he was through talking. Sometimes you have to work out, as you probably know, hand signals or nudges or something like that.
Yep.
So that you can tell each other when you're not going to talk over each other. But he and I never had that problem. He always seemed to know when I was through, and I always seemed to know when he was through.
That's when you know the chemistry works.
Yep, that's exactly right. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you capture that, but that's the way we were.
Well, you probably have, too, been in situations with people where the chemistry didn't work, and it is kind of a stumbling situation there.
Yeah, you were continually interrupting each other and stepping onto each other's lines and stuff like that. We never did that.
You always flew, right? You didn't take the Madden Cruiser with him, did you?
I took it from place to place. I mean, short trips like Chicago to Green Bay or Detroit to Indianapolis or something like that. Enough to eat a lot of meals on the bus, enough Thanksgiving days to enjoy Thanksgiving dinner on the bus. But I didn't take any coast-to-coast or anything like that.
Did you like bus travel?
I didn't mind it, but I didn't see how he could do it and remain in any degree of sanity. It would have run me crazy to go from San Francisco to Miami to Green Bay, as we did in one three-week sequence.
Talking with Pat,
I couldn't have done that.
Talking with legendary broadcaster Pat Summerall, his new book, autobiography called Summerall, On and Off the Air. Let's talk a little bit about your playing days. You got coached in how to be a kicker by Tom Landry.
Tom was my coach at one time. I had become a kicker a long time before that. I was practicing in college at the University of Arkansas, and whoever was kicking off for us was not doing a very good job. I was a sophomore, and they said, if anybody thinks they can kick off, come out 15 minutes early. And I didn't have anything else to do, so I went out 15 minutes early and tried to kick off, and I'd never done it before. And I was pretty successful, so I got the kicking off job and could get the ball in and out of the end zone quite regularly. And then they started working with me when I was in college. In fact, I led the nation in field goals when I was a senior with four.
Four. What do you mean with four?
With four. Now it's four in one game is nothing, or seven in one game, or whatever.
The field goal was not part of the game then?
Not part of the game then. Four led the country
in
field goals.
Was that because the pressure was just get the ball in the end zone?
Well, I think nobody even thought about field goals at that time. Once in a while, we had a coach who had been influenced by the professional leagues, and he came in and he thought, well, you know, they do it in the pros, why not do it in college? So, as I say, I led the nation with four.
And speaking of legendary coaches, not only did you get coached by Tom Landry in New York, but didn't you at one point work with Vince Lombardi?
Well, they were our two assistant coaches. Lombardi ran the offense in New York with the Giants. He was the offensive coordinator, and Tom Landry was the defensive coordinator at the same time. So you didn't need a lot of coaching staff when you had those two.
No, probably not. Now, I'm not from Wisconsin, but having read Jerry Kramer's instant replay when I was a very little boy, I immediately became a Packer fan. And, of course, it was during those halcyon years of the Packer dynasty there in the mid-60s.
Bob Lombardi.
Yeah. And I always was curious about what this guy was like when he wasn't Coach Lombardi. Was there ever a time when he took off that persona?
Not that I remember. I know when I first joined the Giants, he was already an assistant, and we were training in Salem, Oregon. And it was the first day of training camp, and the guys were saying hello. They hadn't seen each other since the close of the previous season. And one of the other assistant coaches was trying to call roll, and he couldn't get us quiet. Everybody was still raucous and still saying hello and patting each other on the back and so on and so forth. And this gentleman walked into the room and cleared his throat. And the whole room was in a hush almost immediately. And I said to the guy who was sitting next to me, "Who the heck is that?" And he said to me, "That's Lombardi, and you'll find out soon enough who he is."
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of demeanor he had. He was, I think, probably he and Landry together, although their styles were completely different, the thing that they were most proficient at and the best at, I think, of anybody ever encountered was their ability to teach. They knew so much about what they were trying to tell you that if you listened to them, and you better listen to them, and you did what they said, you would win. And they were so convincing and such good teachers. I think most coaches that you talk to would like to be remembered as teachers anyway. And they were so good at it, it was just incredible.
Place kicker turned sportscasting icon Pat Summerall. His autobiography is called On and Off the Air. We'll come back and talk more about it in just a moment here as the Paul Harris Show continues on News Talk 1120 KMOX.
Okay, now that thing's the moon. What's this thing right here?
I'm told it's Saturn.
You believe it? You buy Saturn?
I don't know. I know Saturn's got rings around it.
Yeah, it's either Saturn with rings around it or it's our blimp. Is our blimp still up there?
But it doesn't have rings around it.
The blimp doesn't?
No.
I knew the moon. I didn't know that other thing, but that's Saturn, huh? No, there's... Okay, we got our blimp, and we got our moon.
I feel better that you knew the blimp.
Well, I know the blimp and the moon. It's that other thing we call Saturn that I'm not sure of.
Well, I'm not sure either. My information... Drop that to me.
Probably a lot of kids listening that are saying, how can they not know that?
I gave ourselves a chance.
This is the moon. I could come back as a kicker on the moon.
Range is limited.
There's a little bit of the chemistry between Pat Summerall and John Madden during the years. Do you remember that one, Pat?
No, I don't.
I don't know where that was, but he went off on tangents like that, didn't he?
Yes, he did, quite often.
Yeah, and again, I asked you before, and we never got around to this, but were there times where you're thinking to yourself, two plays have just gone by, John, let me get back to calling the game?
Oh, yeah. There were times where I thought, people are watching, and we're talking about the moon and Saturn, and the squirrel running across the field or something like that. Maybe we ought to get back to covering the game. There were times that happened, sure.
You did more than two dozen Super Bowls on TV and radio.
Right.
If my memory serves me, you did the first one, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And it was actually on two networks at the same time.
NBC and CBS.
Now, how did that happen, and what was that like?
Well, there was such a war, I think, between not only between the AFL and the NFL, there was a war between CBS and NBC about who was getting the most money for commercials and who was the highest rated network. And then after the merger, the two leagues agreed that they would play each other. It was called the World Championship Game. It wasn't called the Super Bowl until Lamar Hunt finally called it the Super Bowl. But we had two sets of announcers and one set of cameras. I think we used NBC cameras, but CBS had a set of announcers, and NBC had a set of announcers. So there was a lot of rivalry off the field in that game as well as on the field between the Packers and Kansas City Chiefs.
So you're doing the game, and whoever it was, maybe Kurt Gowdy or whoever it was doing it for...
Kurt Gowdy and Paul Chrisman did the game for NBC, and I did a half with Ray Scott and Jack Whitaker, and Frank Gifford did a half. And Gifford and I swapped plays at the halftime. He became the sideline reporter in the first half, and I was in the booth. And then at the halftime, I went down on the sideline, and Frank went into the booth. So that's the way we covered it.
And for people who may not know this, because it was not a big deal at the time.
No.
Not anything compared to what it is now. In fact, the game was so relatively unimportant that at one point the TV coverage had missed a kickoff.
Half kickoff. That's true.
They missed the second half kickoff. And is it true that somebody went to, I think it was Lombardi, and said, could you guys re-kick that?
Well, they asked me to go to Lombardi.
Really?
And say, would you mind kicking off? NBC missed the second half kickoff. And I refused to do it. I said, I'm not going up to him. If this is my job and that's what you want me to do, I'll find another job. I'm not doing that.
Especially since you knew Lombardi pretty well.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. What was your favorite Super Bowl to do?
Oh, I think that one is the most memorable one because there were 40,000 empty seats. The highest price ticket was $12 as opposed to what it is now, $750, I think. And you can't get a ticket at that price. But I think there was so much confusion. But the Packers really didn't want to play the game because they thought they had already won the World Championship when they beat the Cowboys the week before. And to them, it was sort of an afterthought. So Lombardi had a tough task in getting them ready to play. They didn't want to play. It meant a lot to Kansas City and to the AFL. It was establishing for them their credibility, respectability, whatever. But it was just the atmosphere surrounding that, the production meetings we had where we had both crews together, both of the broadcast crews together, which had never happened before. It was just so many unique things about it that that's probably the most memorable one I've done.
Which was the Super Bowl where you had the headset problem?
That was 16 in Detroit, the first one indoors. The first one that Madden and I did together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Where he sat on my headset? Is that what you're talking about?
That's the story I heard.
Yeah, that's true.
That you had started the opening, and I guess you'd thrown it to him, and you were turning around to get ready to call the game.
That's correct. And he was sitting on my headset. And at that time, he weighed about 340. I don't know what he weighs now, but he was a big-sized, good-sized fella.
Wow.
And I was trying to, while he was answering my second question, and they were on a single shot of him, I was trying to dig my headset out from underneath him so I could start the broadcast and the toss of the coin, the whole thing. And there's no way I could get that headset out. Thank goodness the stage manager realized what was happening and gave me a spare headset, which was not as effective as the one that I'd been rehearsing with. And after John realized what was going on, and after we cut our cameras to the field and got off of him, and then he got up, and then I got my original headset, the one that I had intended to do the game with, which was badly bent out of shape. Until they got it back into shape, it was almost halftime before I got my original headset back where I could wear it.
Wow. Yeah, I would think that anything that Madden at that point sat on would pretty much be bent out of shape.
Pretty well squashed.
Well, what do you say to people who are trying to break into calling the games as play-by-play people? For instance, Chris Collinsworth, who's been doing studio work and has done some analysis of some games, he had talked to NBC about maybe doing play-by-play stuff, and I know he's talked to the NFL Network about that. He wants to break over from being the color guy to the play-by-play guy. You're an ex-jock, and he's an ex-jock, so is there something there that you can impart to somebody like that in how to do the job?
You know, I talked to Chris a long time at last year's Super Bowl, and he had been through that audition. They were going to hire him, I think, to do the play-by-play with Madden when he moved to NBC.
For Sunday nights, yeah.
Yeah. And Chris said that the only thing they told him was do it like Pat did it. And he said, I couldn't do that. I don't know. He said, tell me, how did you do it? And I said, well, I can't describe. It was just something that... It was a chemistry that worked between me and John, and I don't know how to tell you. I know that you don't have to say much, You can be brief with your statement because John is going to carry the broadcast. I knew that was going to be the way it would be with whomever he worked. But I couldn't tell Chris how to get ready or how to prepare. I think that's something you just have to – it just happens and you have to feel it.
Which do you think is the harder job, play-by-play or analyst?
I think the roles have really changed in broadcasting. Now, it used to be when I was an analyst, the play-by-play man, like Jack Buck, like Ray Scott, like Chris Schenkel, the people that I worked with principally, they were in command of the broadcast. So they were the play-by-play man, and it was regimented so that when the team broke the huddle, the analyst didn't speak. When the play was in progress, the analyst didn't speak. When the play was over, after the ball was down, and while the team was in the huddle, that's when the analyst could make his point. Of course, there was no instant replay at that time.
Right.
So the play-by-play man really dominated the broadcast. Now the roles have just about changed completely, whereas the economy of words and the scene-setting job stays with the play-by-play man. But there is no regimentation about when the analyst can talk. If he talks over a play, nobody seems to care. So the role has really changed to where now I think the analyst is the key of the broadcast and the play-by-play man is sort of an afterthought.
I'm Paul Harris talking with Pat Summerall, legendary broadcaster, 4 decades on the air calling NFL games, golf, tennis, the U.S. Open just getting underway. You did that a couple of times, didn't you, Pat?
Oh, several times, yeah. A lot of times.
Was there a sport besides football that you loved to call as a broadcaster?
Oh, I think I enjoyed tennis because I played tennis all my life. I enjoyed golf very much. Once I got into it and got acclimated to the pace of golf, which is very difficult, I think the most difficult sport there is to broadcast. I enjoyed doing golf. I loved doing tennis.
Why do you think golf is so difficult?
Well, because there's nothing happening.
I mean,
how many times can you say he's got a 9-iron, he's 140 yards out, the wind's blowing left or right, he's either going to hit the green or he isn't. There's really not much going on.
Actually,
you talk about the kind of lie he's got. There's so much preparation you have to do about the individuals who are involved, and then you never know if you're going to get to use it or not because you could be on the air, the golf broadcast could be on the air for 3 hours. You might be at the 18th hole, and there'd be no action at the 18th hole for but just 10 minutes of the 3 hours. So you never know. You have to be ready, but you never know when they're coming to you.
Plus, you have to do it in a half whisper.
Yeah, that's another thing, because unlike tennis and unlike golf, unlike football or basketball or whatever the other sport, you react to the noise. In golf, you don't react to the noise.
You have connections to St. Louis because you actually played minor league baseball in the Cardinals organization, didn't you?
That's correct. I did.
With
and, of course, Jack Buck I worked with for a long time, so that was a great connection in St. Louis as well.
Yeah. In fact, I was looking today. I couldn't find it, but I wanted to find some audio of you and Jack working the catch, the 1981 NFC Championship game.
Don't know if we did that game together. I don't think we did that game together. I think Jack was doing radio.
Oh, he was on with Hank?
And he was on with Hank, and I was on television.
Tell me a Jack Buck story if you got one.
Well, gosh, I got so many. Jack really is the reason that I got into play-by-play because he and I were working together, and we were the number one team at CBS. And they had a change in leadership at the CBS Sports Network. A guy named Bob Wasser replaced Bill McPhail, who had been our longtime boss. And Jack and I, as I said, were the number one football team at CBS. And the new boss called me when I lived in New Jersey. And he called me the middle of 1 week, and he said, I need to have lunch with you. And I scampered to New York, and we had lunch. And while we were together, he said to me, I got to split you and Jack Buck. I got to take you apart. And I said, why? Because I thought we were the number one team. He said, you are the best team we've got, but you sound too much alike.
Mm.
I can't tell who's talking when you're speaking and when Jack's speaking. So I want you to work with somebody else. And he said to me, who do you want to work with? I said, you've made up your mind. I was very much against the move. And I said, you've made up your mind. And he said, yes. I said, well, I'd like to work with Tom Brookshire then. So that's how Brookie and I got together in the middle of the season. They didn't even try me out. He said, let's do it the next week. It was on Wednesday when we had that meeting, and on the next Sunday, we did a giant Cardinal game in St. Louis. And that was the beginning of Brookshire and me.
Pat Summerall's autobiography is called On and Off the Air. You have led a remarkable life, 10 years in the NFL, more than four decades on the air on TV and radio. Pretty good for a boy born with one foot backwards, huh?
Yeah. I was born, as is in the book, I was born with my right foot turned around backwards. And the doctor at that time, in 1930, an operation to correct that was almost non-existent. But he took a chance, broke my leg when I was an infant. Of course, I don't remember anything about it. I do remember wearing corrective shoes, but I know I was told later on that he told my parents that I might be able to walk, but I wouldn't be able to run and play with the rest of the people. And as it turned out, that's the leg I kick with.
You proved him wrong.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad I did.
You know, in reading through the book, Pat, there are so many highlights. We've only touched on a few of them here. But I think I know what one of your lowlights is. Not maybe the lowest light, but I think I know what one of them is.
What's that?
You didn't take stock in Madden's video game.
Well, I had a chance to.
Yeah. You took the cash instead.
I took the cash, and he took the stock. If I had taken the stock, you know I'd be just as wealthy as Madden.
Thanks for your time today, Pat. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Paul.
The book is called Summerall, On and Off the Air. Broadcasting legend Pat Summerall here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.